Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include U.S. economy's tariff peril more serious than guacamole, and Duke Energy's power play could cost North Carolina consumers. And we'll begin with U.S. economy's tariff peril more serious than guacamole. When trade tensions with China flared last year, many companies sought refuge in a country with a long, stable relationship with the United States, Mexico. Now, that alternative for production and materials may also be in jeopardy with President Donald Trump's threat to impose escalating tariffs on imports from Mexico, aimed at forcing action on illegal immigration. In the short term, the tariffs would mean lower profits for American importers and higher prices for American consumers on everything from avocados to Volkswagens. In the long run, they could force companies to reconsider the continent-spanning supply chains that have made North America one of the world's most interconnected economies. That disruption, experts warn, could be far more damaging to the U.S. economy than the cost of tariffs themselves. The United States imported more than $345 billion in goods from Mexico last year and shipped $265 billion the other way. But if anything, those numbers understate the interdependence. American refiners process crude oil from Mexico, then sell it back as gasoline. Automakers ship parts back and forth repeatedly during manufacturing. About 30% of the content of Mexican exports originated in the United States, according to a recent study. Our ties to Mexico in many ways are much more immediate than China and in some ways much more powerful, said Pete Guerra, who leads supply chain consulting for Bain. I don't think there's much you could do to mitigate the effects because the changes required would be so substantial. Trump has frequently criticized Mexico and U.S. companies that relocate production there, but his trade policies have largely focused on China, a target of successive rounds of tariffs on billions of dollars in imports. U.S. companies have responded by moving production and supply chains out of China, and in some cases to Mexico, which this year has displaced China as the United States' top trading partner. The attraction of doing so only increased when the United States, Mexico, and Canada reached a deal last fall to replace the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now those plans have been thrown into turmoil. Mexico was the place that people were looking to move to, said Joseph Fitzgerald, a partner in Deloitte Supply Chain Practice. Now it's, gosh, we just got through one wave of supply chain strategy and structural change, and now we need to start a new round. BD, a medical technology company, said last month that it was moving some of its manufacturing to Mexico from China, in part because of the Trump administration's tariffs. Troy Kirkpatrick, a BD spokesman, said Friday that the company was still in the process of making the shift, involving diagnostic devices and other products, and was assessing the latest tariff announcement. Trump said in a Twitter post Thursday evening that he would impose a 5% tariff on Mexican imports June 10th, and ratcheted up to 25% by October if the immigration issues were not resolved. If the tariffs materialize, consumers could feel them almost immediately, most likely starting with the price of fresh fruits and vegetables, a competitive market with slim margins where distributors would have little choice but to pass on cost. As a consumer, that was my first thought, said Emily Blanchard, an economist at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. Those are my avocados and strawberries. What are you doing? For other products, the reverberations could be more gradual. Companies may initially absorb some of the cost to avoid losing business, particularly on higher-margin items or ones where they face competition from domestic producers. But economic research shows that consumers eventually bear the brunt of tariffs. The impact could be greater in the case of trade with Mexico because so many imports from there contain parts or materials from U.S. factories. We're taxing ourselves on our own goods, said Catherine Russ, an economist at the University of California, Davis. Economists said the direct effects of a tariff of 5% or even 10% would probably be small, especially with a strong economy and low inflation. The larger threat, they said, was the disruption they could cause for automakers and others who have come to rely on supply chains that seamlessly cross international boundaries. Those supply chains will not fray overnight, said Brian Dunch, a trade expert at PricewaterhouseCoopers, but over time they could break down, particularly if companies decide they cannot trust trade rules to be consistent from one year to the next. It's the cumulative effect of all this uncertainty, Dunch said. You'll see supply chains balance. Agriculture and food exports to Mexico totaled $19 billion in 2018, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Of the top five exports, which include corn, soybeans, beef and dairy products, pork and pork products were most affected by the previous round of Mexico's retaliatory efforts. During the first quarter of this year, for example, pork exports across the southern border dropped by $109 million, compared with the same three-month period in 2018. Trump's tariff announcement sent a jolt through medical device makers, which in recent years have built facilities in places like Tijuana that produce items like pacemakers, artificial respirators, and intravenous bags. Last year, the United States imported medical equipment from Mexico worth nearly $8 billion, according to government trade statistics. And next, Duke Energy is pushing a Trojan horse, which, while disguised as legislation to give state regulators more flexibility, would permit Duke to earn excessive profits at customers' expense without the comprehensive scrutiny it currently receives from regulators. Far from helping regulators or anyone else other than Duke, Senate Bill 559 is an attempt to pocket additional money for Duke Energy, the chief driver of the bill. SB 559 opens the door for Duke to be allowed to raise its rates annually to collect from ratepayers an estimated $10 billion in coal ash cleanup cost and $13 billion in grid modernization cost over the next decade. But like the mythical Trojan horse, SB 559 appears harmless from the outside. The bill, which passed the Senate and currently pending in the House, contains two parts. The first part would allow Duke Energy or North Carolina's other power provider, Dominion Energy, to sell bonds to pay storm costs. The second part of Senate Bill 559 is far more insidious for consumers and regulators. It would allow Duke and Dominion to ask the NC Utilities Commission for successive rate increases, covering up to 5 years, upending the current system in which each utility must ask each time it wants to change rates and face an extensive review. In addition to reducing rate-making scrutiny and locking residential and business consumers into higher rates for multiple years, the legislation has the potential to strip power from the Utilities Commission. Under current law, Duke and Dominion are bound by the Commission's final ruling on rate increase request unless appealed to a higher court. But under SB 559, if Duke or Dominion doesn't like the Commission's decision on its 5-year rate increase application, it can simply withdraw its request and revert back to rules that were in place prior to enactment of SB 559. It defies all judicial sense that an entity being regulated can dismiss the Commission's orders if they do not align with its business incentives. The only stakeholders benefiting from SB 559 are Duke Energy and Dominion Energy, which is why no consumer advocates, no clean energy advocates, no business customers support the legislation. This bill comes at a time when Duke is ramping up to collect from customers an estimated $23 billion in coal ash cleanup and energy grid improvements cost, and SB 559 is an avenue for Duke to pass these bills on to consumers. Beyond the cost arguments, bill opponents warn that the new rules could block competition from other energy providers, particularly those offering renewable energy solutions. In its advocacy for SB 559, Duke claims that North Carolina's energy regulation is in need of reform. But if the system is so problematic, it would be far more prudent to perform a comprehensive examination to consider all aspects of utility regulation in our state. All this legislation would have to do is add two new rate mechanisms cherry-picked by Duke to benefit energy providers. Members of the General Assembly should see SB 559 for what it really is, a power play that strips authority from state regulators and passes higher cost onto consumers while serving to hinder other beneficial energy opportunities for our state. And next, crumbling roads, spotty internet cause trouble for U.S. businesses. Every hour that one of the Advance Group's trucks is stuck in highway or bridge traffic, it costs the moving company around $200, and with 40 trucks trying to get into Manhattan daily and contending with New York Metro's area's deteriorating infrastructure, the price of long-time runs up quickly. Lost time runs up quickly. Getting to and from a job site is not really billable to a client, said Anthony Parzelli, president of the Advance Group based in the suburb of Farmingdale. Parzelli's company and other small mid-sized businesses want the federal government to follow through on a promise to rebuild the nation's infrastructure, not just roads and bridges, but also extending broadband coverage to rural areas where internet and cell phone service is poor or non-existent. Improving and fixing the roads in New York would help traffic flow faster, even with the area's congestion, Parzelli said. He wants to see officials deal with New York's ongoing pothole problems that damage his fleet from the area's pitted roads and cost the company $65,000 each winter. It's becoming more challenging to conduct business, he said. The Trump administration and Democrats in Congress earlier this month publicly agreed that the nation needs $2 trillion for infrastructure upgrades. But quick action looks unlikely. President Donald Trump said last week he would not negotiate with Democrats while they are investigating his administration. And a bill would have to win support from both parties. The number two Republican in the House, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, has already said the $2 trillion figure is too high. In a January survey of 1,001 small business owners and operators released by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, 56% said the quality of their high-speed internet was good, and 58% said cell phone network coverage was good. Those somewhat slim majorities reflect dissatisfaction among a considerable portion of owners. Roads and bridges got lower marks. 62% of the owners rated local roads and bridges as having between very poor and average quality, and 52% gave the same ratings to the highways. Owners in the Northeast gave the lowest marks to infrastructure compared to ratings by owners in other regions, but across the country, owners were most dissatisfied with the highways. All businesses must deal with the added expense caused by poor infrastructure, but smaller companies don't have the revenue cushions that large businesses use to absorb the cost of lost time and repairs. At the 225 franchises of Advanta Clean, a company that cleans buildings, air systems, staffers spend about half their time traveling from one appointment to another, and highway and road problems cut into the amount of time spent doing the real work, President Matt Phillips says. Significant changes to our infrastructure could reduce our expenses as much as 35% and help increase revenue by 25%, Phillips says. It's not just the time, but also fuel wasted by slow-moving traffic that drives up cost, he said. Phillips' crews have the most problems in the Northeast, which has older, more dilapidated infrastructure, and the Southeast, where roads are crowded due to the region's fast growth. In many areas, it's not possible to build entirely new highways, but roadways can be widened in projects that take years, but that ultimately allow traffic to move faster. A 35-mile stretch of the New Jersey Turnpike was widened to 6 lanes in each direction from 3. It took 5 years to complete. When bridges are replaced, lanes can be added. When the Governor Mario M. Cuomo Bridge replaced the Taipan Z Bridge across the Hudson River north of New York City, the new double span was given 8 traffic lanes compared to 7 on the old bridge. For many small businesses, including those in rural areas or whose customers are far from metro areas, the infrastructure problem is about broadband coverage needed to move information across cell phones and the internet. Internet service is poor in the Catskill Mountains, 130 miles north of Manhattan. Lita Wall, who owns Cold Spring Lodge, has Wi-Fi through her cable provider for her guest and also to run the business. But the internet service is spotty because of the mountains, often failing during poor weather, and cell phone service is equally unreliable. The area, which has many dead zones where there is no service, needs more cell phone towers. Wall has a landline phone for voice calls. Wall also owns a restaurant in Manhattan's East Village neighborhood, but even in the heavily populated city, she struggles with poor internet connections. Sometimes it is down and we don't notice until later, and so have issues with customers who send orders during the time the system is down, Wall says. At those times, she needs to connect to the internet using her cell phone at what's known as a hotspot, an added expense each month. And next, practical steps help ensure you can work as long as you like. Many people plan to work past normal retirement age by choice or necessity, but most aren't taking the steps that could increase the odds they'll be able to do so. When asked what they're doing to ensure they can continue working past 65, fewer than half of the employees polled in the 2019 Transamerica Retirement Survey of workers say they're trying to stay healthy. Similar numbers cited performing well in their current positions, 43%, or keeping their job skills up to date, 40%. More than one in four workers say they aren't doing anything to ensure they remain employed longer. Workers of the world wake up. Bad health, layoffs, and age discrimination sideline many people who expected to work longer. Surveys show that anywhere from 37% to 56% of retirees leave the job market earlier than planned. That can be catastrophic for personal finances and retirement. The employment deck is stacked against workers as they grow older. Few companies offer age-friendly policies that could keep people in the workplace longer, such as formal phased retirement programs. Even employers that have diversity and inclusion policies typically don't include age as one of the demographic characteristics they're trying to promote, a previous Transamerica survey found. Meanwhile, study after study shows it's much harder for older workers who lose their jobs to find new ones. You can do everything right and still not be guaranteed a long working life. For the best shot at working past 65, it pays to be proactive. There are all these stereotypes about older workers, and you basically want to be the antithesis of them, said Laurie McMahon, senior attorney for AARP Foundation. Stay engaged. Workers 55 and older are more likely to be enthusiastic about and committed to their work than younger generations, according to a 2015 AARP poll. Older workers need to put that engagement on display. You don't want to be viewed as the person who's coasting to retirement, McCann said, so you want to remain productive, to volunteer, to basically be assertive. Being assertive doesn't mean talking down to younger coworkers. Instead, McCann suggests volunteering for projects and age-diverse work teams with the attitude that you have something to contribute. You might say, I think I could add a different perspective to that team. If there's an opportunity for me to work on it, then I would like to, she said. Keep learning. We're living in a world where nearly half of all jobs are vulnerable to automation, and many occupations of the future haven't been invented yet. So it may not be enough to be good at what you do. You'll want to get good at what your company or industry needs next. Try asking your boss or human resources folks about what skills are currently hard for them to find. Stay up to date on your field's technology, consider adding credentials, and be greedy about new experiences, said Barbara Mystic, co-author of Stretch, How to Future-Proof Yourself for Tomorrow's Workplace, and president of Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Mystic says she attends at least one conference a year that's outside her field just to meet new people and learn new things. She also creates a plan every year for her career growth. People kind of think someone is going to take care of it for them, but your professional development is your own responsibility, she said. Our social and professional circles can shrink as we age. If we want to stay engaged, we should keep diversifying our networks with people of various ages and in different industries, since our next jobs may be entirely new fields, said Catherine Collinson, CEO and president of the nonprofit Transamerica Institute and Transamerica Center for Retirement Studies. Networking can help you meet new people, build professional relationships, inspire new ways of thinking, and identify career opportunities, Collinson says. Mystic says it's also important for older workers to have some kind of social media presence. She recommends picking one or two avenues, LinkedIn and Twitter, for example, and focusing your efforts there. You don't have to do them all, but you can't do none either, she says. And next, burned out at work? Now you can get a doctor's note. In updating its Handbook of Diseases, the World Health Organization has defined burnout as an official condition or occupational phenomenon. Doctors can diagnose someone with burnout if they show three symptoms: depletion or exhaustion, mental distance or negativity toward their job, and reduced ability to complete tasks. WHO says burnout is a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. This should have happened a long time ago, said Bob Preziosi, professor emeritus at Leadership and Human Resources Management at Nova Southeastern University's Huizinga College of Business in Davie, Florida. We have all seen people suffer physically and emotionally from burnout. This happens in businesses, public agencies, and even not-for-profits. WHO reached the decision to update its definition of burnout during its recent World Health Assembly in Geneva. A diagnosis of burnout, however, would not apply to anxiety or mood disorders. In the U.S., researchers have been studying burnout as workplaces have become more demanding and workers more attached to their smartphones in response to 24/7 demands. Studies show it leads to outcomes such as substance abuse, severe depression, suicide, and physical health conditions. Preziosi said he has seen burnout in the state's white and blue-collar workers. In Florida, pressure stems in part from tourism demands and rush periods, or businesses need to stay ahead of competitors. It harms productivity eventually, he said. The precursor is when people start to get testy and take it out on their coworkers, family, and even their pets. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.